A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Picture a highway. Six lanes of black ribbon unspooling toward the horizon, white dashes flicking past, maybe a gentle crown in the middle for drainage. It looks simple. Melt some black stuff, spread it flat, let it cool. What's to engineer?
That's exactly what makes road engineering one of the most invisibly sophisticated disciplines in modern civil infrastructure. What you're actually looking at is a precision-layered composite structure that goes about 3 feet into the ground, designed using physics models that predict stress and strain under millions of load cycles, laid by GPS, guided machines that hold tolerances of plus or minus 2 millimeters.
On something trucks are going to pound at 70 miles an hour for the next 30 years.
And here's why this matters right now. Global infrastructure spending is at an all-time high, autonomous vehicles are demanding surfaces more perfect than anything we've built before, and the difference between a road that lasts 8 years and one that lasts 30 comes down to engineering decisions made decades before the first crack appears.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about how road-laying technology has changed in ways that aren't obvious when you're just driving on the finished product. His point is that a well-laid multi-lane highway in a modern developed country is genuinely a piece of static engineering, not just a construction project.
I love that phrase. It doesn't move, so we assume it's simple. But a bridge announces itself. You see the cables, the towers, you feel the engineering. A highway just lies there, quietly doing more structural work than most buildings ever will.
If a highway is doing more structural work than most buildings, what's it actually made of? Because from the driver's seat, it's just blacktop on dirt. That's the illusion.
Right. And that illusion is about 3 feet thick. A modern road is a layered composite. You start with the subgrade, which is the native soil at the bottom, compacted to at least 95% of its maximum density. On top of that goes the subbase, usually 6 to 12 inches of granular material, crushed stone or gravel. Then the base course, another 4 to 8 inches of stabilized aggregate. Only then do you get to the asphalt itself, which is typically two layers, a binder course and a wearing course, together another 4 to 8 inches.
What I'm driving on is the top 2 inches of a carefully stacked cake that goes down to my knees.
And every layer has a job. The subgrade provides the foundation. The subbase drains water and distributes load. The base course resists deformation. The binder course handles the heavy structural stresses, and the wearing course, the top inch or so, is the sacrificial surface that takes the direct abuse from tires and weather.
The wearing course is sacrificial. I like that. It's the road's skin, basically.
And just like skin, it's designed to be replaced while the structure beneath stays intact. But here's where the real shift happened. For most of the 20th century, road design was empirical. Engineers in, say, Illinois would build roads based on what had worked in Illinois before. Local experience, local materials, local rules of thumb. The 1993 AASH Tow Design Guide was the Bible, and it was entirely empirical.
We've always done it this way, and the roads haven't collapsed yet.
That's basically it. And it worked, until traffic loads exploded and materials changed. Then in the 1990s and early 2000s, the whole field pivoted to what's called mechanistic empirical design. The big milestone was the Mechanistic Empirical Pavement Design Guide, the MEPDG, released in 2004. Instead of asking what worked before, it asks, what do the physics say? Layered elastic theory, finite element models, you plug in traffic loads, climate data, material properties, and it predicts exactly where cracks will form and how deep ruts will get over 30 years.
The road went from folk wisdom to physics.
That's the arc we want to trace. We'll go from the ground up, the hidden foundation layers, then the chemistry of the asphalt itself, then the machines that lay it, and finally the quality control that makes sure a 30-year design actually lasts 30 years.
Let's actually walk through those layers, because I think most of us imagine a road as maybe 4 inches of asphalt on some gravel and call it done. You're telling me there's a whole hidden architecture down there.
And the subgrade is where everything starts. That's the native soil at the bottom, and if you get it wrong, nothing above it can save you. Engineers compact it to at least 95% of what's called Proctor density, which is the maximum density you can achieve at the optimum moisture content. Too dry and it won't compact. Too wet and it turns to pudding.
You're engineering dirt before you even touch a road material.
You absolutely are. Then, on top of that goes the subbase, 6 to 12 inches of granular material, usually crushed stone or gravel. Its main job is drainage. Water is the enemy of every road. If water sits in the structure, it softens the subgrade. It freezes and expands. It pumps fines up through cracks. The subbase is what keeps the foundation dry.
The base course above that?
That's another 4 to 8 inches of crushed stone, often stabilized with a little cement or asphalt. This layer is the real workhorse for load distribution. When a 40-ton truck rolls over the surface, the pressure at the tire is about 100 pounds per square inch. By the time that force reaches the subgrade, the base course has spread it out to maybe 5 psi.
The whole structure is a pressure dispersion machine.
That's exactly what it is. And here's where the MEPDG changed everything. The old empirical method would say, in this region, with this soil, use 14 inches of asphalt. The mechanistic empirical approach models the actual physics. It calculates the tensile strain at the bottom of the asphalt layer, the compressive strain at the top of the subgrade, and predicts how many load cycles each can take before failure.
Failure means what, specifically? Because roads don't just vanish one day.
Three main modes. Fatigue cracking. That's the alligator pattern you see on old roads. It starts at the bottom of the asphalt, where bending creates the highest tensile stress. Microcracks form, propagate upward, and eventually connect. The road essentially flexes itself to death over millions of cycles.
Like bending a paperclip until it snaps.
Then there's rutting. Permanent grooves in the wheel paths. That can happen in the asphalt itself if it's too soft in summer heat, or deep in the subgrade if the foundation wasn't compacted properly. And third, thermal cracking. Those long transverse cracks perpendicular to the road, caused by the asphalt shrinking in cold weather. Each of these is modeled separately in the MEPDG, with different equations and different material inputs.
All of this modeling is based on actual data, not just theory.
Right. And that's where the Long-Term Pavement Performance Program comes in. It's one of the largest civil engineering studies ever conducted. The Federal Highway Administration started it in 1987, and over more than 20 years, they instrumented over 2,500 test sections across North America. Different climates, different soils, different traffic loads. They measured everything, cracking, rutting, deflection, roughness, and built the databases that power modern design models.
2,500 test sections. That's not a study. That's a census.
It's monumental. And one of the tools they use to validate the layered elastic theory is something called a fall-in weight deflectometer. It's a trailer-mounted device that drops a heavy weight onto the pavement, simulating a truck wheel load, while sensors measure how much the road surface deflects at various distances from the impact. The deflection basin tells you exactly how stiff each layer is. If the measurements don't match the model, you know something's wrong underground.
It's an MRI for roads.
That's exactly what it is. And it's how we discovered that a lot of roads were failing from the bottom up. The subgrade was the culprit, not the asphalt. You can't see it from the surface until it's too late.
Which brings us to pavement preservation. Because if you know a road is starting to degrade, you don't have to wait for it to fall apart.
This is the part that most people, including the people who fund roads, don't fully appreciate. Pavement preservation isn't just patching potholes. It's a systematic approach, micro-surfacing, which puts down a thin layer of polymer-modified slurry to seal the surface. Chip sealing, where you spray hot asphalt and cover it with aggregate. Crack sealing to keep water out of the structure. These treatments can extend a road's life by 5 to 10 years, at 20 to 30% of the cost of full reconstruction.
A dollar spent early saves $6 to $10 later. That's a return you'd take in any other investment.
Yet it's politically harder to fund preservation than new construction. Nobody cuts a ribbon for a chip seal. But from an engineering perspective, it's the single most cost-effective thing you can do. The road is a living asset. You maintain it, or you rebuild it. There's no third option. Now that we understand the structure, let's talk about the material itself. Because the phrase asphalt covers a lot of sins. What most people call tar, or blacktop, is actually a carefully engineered mixture, 85 to 95% aggregate by weight, and the rest is binder. And that binder is where the chemistry gets fascinating.
Aggregate being what, exactly? Crushed rock? Sand? Gravel?
Right. Graded and sorted by size, from coarse down to fine, packed together so the smaller particles fill the gaps between the larger ones. Maximum density, minimum voids. But the binder is the glue, and for most of history, it was just whatever crude-derived bitumen was available locally. If it got soft in summer, your road rutted. If it got brittle in winter, it cracked. You were at the mercy of the crude source.
The binder was basically the weakest link, and nobody had a way to specify what they actually needed.
Until the 1990s, when a massive research program called SHRP, the Strategic Highway Research Program, developed the SuperPave system. Superior Performing Asphalt Pavements. Instead of saying, give us penetration grade 60-70, which is a single measurement at one temperature, SuperPave grades binders by performance across the full temperature range the road will actually experience.
You're matching the chemistry to the climate.
A binder is labeled PG-something performance graded. PG64-22 is a common one. The first number is the high temperature grade in Celsius. It means the binder resists rutting up to 64 degrees. The second number is the low temperature grade. It won't thermally crack down to minus 22.
If you're building a road in Phoenix versus a road in Minnesota, those numbers are going to be completely different.
Phoenix might need PG76-10. Northern Minnesota might need PG52-40. Same fundamental material, but the chemistry is tuned. And beyond grading, we've got polymer modification, adding styrene, butadiene styrene, styrene, SBS, or similar polymers that create a three-dimensional elastic network within the binder. It stretches and recovers instead of permanently deforming.
It's like adding rubber bands to the glue.
That's not far off. And there's another revolution happening right now, warm mix asphalt. Traditional hot mix has to be produced at about 300 degrees Fahrenheit. Warm mix technologies, chemical additives, or foaming processes let you mix and lay at 30 to 50 degrees lower.
Which means less energy, less emissions, and I'm guessing you can pave in colder weather.
You can extend the paving season by weeks on both ends, and the workers aren't standing in a cloud of 300 degree fumes. It's a triple win. But here's the thing, none of this material science matters if you can't lay it precisely. Which brings us to the machine.
Which I'm guessing has come a long way from a guy with a rake.
A long way. Early 20th century paving was basically hand labor. Crews raking hot mix, tamping it by hand, rolling with steamrollers that had no instruments at all. Today's machines, like the Virgoli Super 2100-3i, are essentially mobile robotic factories. They use a floating screed, that's the rear plate that smooths the asphalt, with automatic grade and slope control. Ultrasonic sensors track a reference wire or the existing surface. Some systems use 3D GPS to hold the screed to a digital model of the finished surface.
That's where the plus or minus 2 millimeters comes from.
That's it. The paver knows exactly where it is in three-dimensional space and adjusts the screed angle in real time. But the machine is only half the story. The hidden art is compaction. You can lay a perfect mat, and if the rolling is wrong, the road fails early.
What's the golden rule?
The paver must never stop. Every time it stops, the screed settles slightly into the hot mat, creating what's called a stop mark, a visible ridge that's also a structural weak point. So modern paving is a logistics ballet. A constant stream of dump trucks feeding the paver moving continuously, and the compaction rollers following behind in a carefully choreographed sequence.
The rollers themselves. You mentioned intelligent compaction.
They're fitted with accelerometers and GPS. As they roll, they measure the stiffness of the mat in real time, building a color-coded map of the entire project. The operator sees exactly where density is adequate and where it's not. No guesswork, no core samples needed after the fact. Uniform compaction is the single biggest predictor of pavement life.
The material and the machine co-evolved. You couldn't lay modern polymer modified asphalt with a 1920s paver, and you wouldn't get the full benefit of a modern paver if you fed it ungraded binder.
That's the key insight, and there's one more piece that ties it all together. Reclaimed asphalt pavement, or RAP. When you mill up an old road, that material isn't waste. Modern plants can incorporate up to 50% recycled material. The aggregate is still good, and the aged binder can be reactivated.
Binder? That's been baking in the sun for 20 years. Surely it's degraded.
It's oxidized and stiff, so you add rejuvenators. Bio-based oils, often derived from soy or other plant sources, that restore the binder's flexibility. It's like moisturizer for old asphalt. You get a new road at lower cost, lower carbon footprint, and you're not landfilling millions of tons of material.
The road eats its own tail. Literally, circular engineering.
That's where we are now. The chemistry, the machine, the logistics, and the recycling, they all have to work together. A modern highway isn't just asphalt on dirt. It's a precision manufactured product, installed by robots, made partly from its own past. What does all of this mean for the person who just drives on these things? Because that's ultimately who this is for, the road user who never thinks about any of it.
Three things, I think. First, when you're on a smooth highway, the kind where you can let go of the wheel for a second, and the car tracks dead straight, no vibration, no thrum, you're not just experiencing good construction. You're experiencing soil mechanics, polymer chemistry, layered elastic theory, and GPS-guided robotics, all working together decades after the decisions were made. It's static engineering, but it's not simple engineering. It's cumulative.
The smoothness isn't cosmetic. Roughness, what engineers call the International Roughness Index, correlates directly with pavement life. A smooth road distributes loads evenly. A rough road pounds itself apart. So that silky surface is a structural feature, not a luxury.
Second thing, next time you drive past a road construction project, you can actually read what you're seeing. Is there a modern paver with a floating screed, or is it older equipment? Are the compaction rollers running GPS and accelerometer rigs on the drums? If there's almost no visible steam coming off the mat, that's probably warm mix asphalt. Lower emissions, better workability. These are the signs of a project that's using current engineering, not just meeting minimum spec.
Look for the continuous feed, too. If you see the paver stopped and a gap between trucks, that's a quality problem in real time. A well-run paving operation looks almost boring. Constant motion, no drama, nobody running around. The logistics are the quality control.
The third thing is, for anyone who has any say in infrastructure spending, a town council member, a planning board volunteer, someone who shows up to budget meetings, pavement preservation is not optional maintenance. It's the highest return investment in the whole transportation system. A dollar spent on crack sealing or microsurfacing at the right time saves $6 to $10 in full reconstruction later.
The engineering community has known this for decades. The LTPP data proves it beyond any doubt, but preservation doesn't photograph well. It doesn't get ribbon cuttings. So the political incentives push toward letting roads degrade until they need complete rebuilding, which is the most expensive possible strategy.
The road is a living asset. You either maintain it or you replace it. There's no third option, and the second one costs 10 times as much.
That brings us to an open question I've been chewing on. As autonomous vehicles become common, and they're coming faster than most road agencies are planning for, do the surfaces themselves need to evolve? Some researchers are pushing smart roads with embedded sensors that communicate directly with vehicles. But I suspect the fundamental layered structure we just described isn't going anywhere.
The physics doesn't change just because the driver is a computer. Load distribution, water drainage, thermal expansion, none of that cares who's steering.
What might change is the precision requirement. Autonomous vehicles rely on consistent surface markings and predictable geometry. A 2 millimeter tolerance might become the floor, not the ceiling. But the real frontier is probably materials.
Self-healing roads. I've heard whispers about this.
It's real, and it's in pilot stages. The concept is you mix steel fibers into the asphalt, and when microcracks form, you run an induction coil over the surface. The steel heats up, the bitumen melts just enough to flow back into the cracks, and the road essentially stitches itself closed. The Dutch have been testing this for over a decade now.
The road gets a fever and heals itself. That's either brilliant or deeply unsettling.
Both, I think. And there's another direction. Photocatalytic pavements. Titanium dioxide mixed into the surface layer. When sunlight hits it, it catalyzes a reaction that breaks down nitrogen oxides, the pollutants from vehicle exhaust, into harmless nitrates that wash away with rain. It's essentially a road that cleans the air above it.
A road that eats smog. We've come a long way from melt some black stuff and spread it flat.
These are pilot projects now, but in 10 to 15 years, they could be standard specifications. The point is that the road isn't a finished technology. It's still evolving, layer by layer, molecule by molecule.
The next time you're on a highway, just remember, there's about 3 feet of precision engineering under your tires, and somewhere a civil engineer is already working on version 2.0.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for making this episode happen.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Nutmeg is the only spice that contains a psychoactive compound called myristicin, which can cause hallucinations if consumed in large quantities, though the dose required is dangerously close to the lethal dose, making it one of the least practical recreational substances in recorded history.
A lot of information about nutmeg I didn't ask for.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.